Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties.
The way you get to that point is Fort Missoula by 1900 is kind of outliving its usefulness. And they want to get rid of it, just like they had done with some of its contemporaries earlier. But what happens is they lobby for the continuation of Fort Missoula, and it's effectively completely rebuilt. And it's a brand new Fort Missoula after just before World War I. And of course, it's even more of a cash grab, kind of pointless. Like, why do you need a brand new multi-million dollar military facility in Western Montana in like 1920? So it's pretty quiet. But the Great Depression leads to the CCC being based out of there. So, Fort Missoula, yeah, it was the regional headquarters for the CCC. Yeah, so a lot of extra support buildings were constructed for the CCC, which by the time 1941 rolls around, you're left with a pretty empty Fort Missoula with a lot of support structures. It's the perfect place if you want to put people there.
Fort Missoula was built in 1877 largely because of the fear among settlers of the Native American population, but it was also built in part as an economic opportunity, creating jobs for locals. For most of the next several decades, Fort Missoula had a fairly peaceful existence, providing office space for the Forest Service and the Civilian Conservation Corps, among other organizations. But it is mostly known today for a couple of its darker chapters. Austin Haney is the education assistant at Fort Missoula, and I had a chance to talk with him about the importance of Fort Missoula's history and also how the fort has been impacted by some of the cuts in federal funding. Let's start with, I know you posted the message that you got when you were informed that they were going to cut some of the funding. How did they word it?
Oh, the quote was literally that our museum, quote, no longer serves the interests of the United States.
Oh, which, okay.
Yeah, that doesn't sit well.
Yeah, which basically means you're bringing too many negative historical events to light, right?
It's not happy-go-lucky, hunky-dory, Disneyland, frontier town kind of history.
Yeah, you guys actually tell the truth.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. And unfortunately, there's a lot more of two of those categories than the first one. So
yeah. Well, we'll get to the details of that a little bit later, but why don't you talk about where you grew up and when you started to become interested in history?
I've lived in Montana my whole life. My dark secret is that I was born in Billings, but I've grown up in the Great Falls area most of my life, and that's home to me. So I got interested in history from a really young age. My grandpas were really interested in history. And so I ended up actually getting dragged, so to speak, to all sorts of different fun things that were going on around Montana, just in terms of battlefields, museums. I got indoctrinated early. So,
and it was something you took a liking to immediately, or? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I was young when the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial was coming around. Mm. And so, like, seeing what was going on, the celebrations for that, going to the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center, I like to joke that I kind of grew up in that building. But that was kind of the gateway as well for, like, seeing that stuff go down and just having that influence from my grandpas. And just, I got hooked. I loved it. You know, other kids were like playing basketball and reading, you know, I don't even know what kids were reading because while they were
Harry
doing that,
Potter,
I was,
probably.
Yeah, Harry Potter or something like that. Meanwhile, the first book I can remember reading was a biography of George Washington and George III.
So then did you study it in college?
Yeah. So I ended up going to the University of Montana and got a degree in history.
And when did you start working at the fort?
Yeah, so I had a couple years in the Park Service before that.
Where were you stationed?
Oh, I was up at Bearpaw Battlefield for 3 years, but I also helped out at Big Hole Battlefield and our main office in Lapway, Idaho. So we were all units of Nez Perce National Historic Park, and that's what we were considered, but we had different stations, if you will, at different locations along that trail. And I was at the very end of it, all by myself. It was, yeah.
Pretty isolated. Tell me how you ended up at the fort then.
Things were kind of starting to get a little dicey on the federal side. I kind of was seeing some writing on the wall that maybe this isn't where I want to spend the rest of my career. And I was kind of debating what the heck I was going to do. And out of the blue, Fort Missoula, a job as the education assistant came up, interviewed, and it was a no-brainer. Like, I wanted to come back to Missoula and be a little less isolated for a bit. And yeah, so I just jumped at the chance, and I knew the history, I knew the stories, and it's a compelling place and really something that I wanted to be a part of. It had the Nez Perce story. It basically was a combination of everything that I already do, but with room to grow and do more. And I really, really was drawn to that, particularly the alien detention story, like that right there. Like, I knew I'd find interest in it, being said it was new. I didn't realize it was gonna have the effect on me that it has. So.
Well, talk about the Nez Perce part of the story.
Fort Missoula was established in the summer of 1877, and within a month, it was already being put into action for the Nez Perce War. I mean, it wasn't even built yet. It was just a collection of tents and guys chopping down trees, trying to make buildings. And the Nez Perce came up over the Bitterroots and down the Lolo Trail, and word had gotten to Missoula, and the people panicked.
And yeah, this was the Chief Joseph.
So, yeah, the people panicked in Missoula, and the soldiers were called out to go up the trail and stop them. And Fort Fizzle is kind of the thing that comes from this. They get the genius idea of thinking that, well, if we build a log barricade at the narrowest point of the canyon, that ought to stop them. Needless to say, they were pretty surprised when they saw the Nez Perce riding up and around. Kind of waving down, like, hey, nice corral you got there, guys.
They were a little smarter than they gave them credit for.
It's extremely complicated. That is a gross oversimplification of it. But so literally about a week later, reinforcements arrive at Fort Missoula. They go down after the Nez Perce and they ambush them with Big Hole. And it's really, really a dark moment in Montana's history, just in terms of, you know, these were people that were just trying to find refuge and safety somewhere else. And they had this misunderstanding about how things were going to work when they got to Montana. And they're ambushed in the morning. People are sleeping in their teepees. And three volleys later, and chaos in a battle, you get 90 people who lose their lives over, you know, just all this stuff going on in the West. So,
yeah.
And that's a huge part of Fort Missoula's story. It's our bloody start. It sets us up for what happens next. You know, that's kind of the story of Fort Missoula is what happens next.
Yeah, well, go into that then.
So the thing about Fort Missoula is you'd think a military fort in the middle of western Montana, it's kind of pointless, right? Yeah, a lot of people felt that even back then, that it was kind of just a cash grab excuse to, you know, get government contracts. Oh,
It was
go ahead.
never really a fort either, right? It's just a bunch of buildings, right?
I mean, at first glance, yeah, it definitely is like that. I mean, they never put in a wall. They never did anything like that because it was an open plan, open concept fort, which is kind of a weird thing to a lot of people when you think of a fort. 1880s, really, really quiet. Nothing's really going on. A lot of other forts around Montana are closing down, but it really came into its own in a dark way again in the 1890s. So 1888, probably the most famous, and I don't want to call it happy story because it's not a happy story, but the 25th Infantry is stationed at Fort Missoula in 1888, and they're all African American with white officers. It's a segregated regiment.
Sure.
And they're most famous for going on their grand bike ride
Right.
in the summer of 1896 and 97. I mean, they go all the way to Yellowstone and back, then they go all the way to St. Louis the next summer, and it's like, oh, the Buffalo soldiers on bicycles, that's the only thing people want to talk about with them. But they have a really complicated history, and they're one of my favorite stories there because, you know, th these are people who have just come out of the Civil War era
Yeah.
and slavery. I mean, these guys were mostly born slaves or the kids of slaves. This is their way of claiming their place in the country. They view the army as, you know, a steady job with some respect and some weight to it that, you know, if we do what we're supposed to do, you know, maybe this will get us a better place in life. And they're used to remove the Salish out of the Bitterroot. They're used to deport the Cree from Western Montana in conjunction with their kind of sister regiment, 10th Cavalry, stationed out of Fort Assiniboine and Havre. But yeah, it's black soldiers in the 1890s who are forced to really kind of mop up after the violence of the 1870s and into the 80s. And that's a story that people don't want to talk about because it's not happy like the bicycles. It's a tough story with complications. I mean, everyone's got something. Everyone's got
Yeah.
something.
And then, of course, further down the road, we have the internment.
The way you get to that point is Fort Missoula by 1900 is kind of outliving its usefulness. And they want to get rid of it, just like they had done with some of its contemporaries earlier. But what happens is they lobby for the continuation of Fort Missoula, and it's effectively completely rebuilt. And it's a brand new Fort Missoula after just before World War One. And of course, it's even more of a cash grab, kind of pointless. Like, why do you need a brand new multi-million dollar military facility in Western Montana in like 1920? So it's pretty quiet, but the Great Depression leads to the CCC being based out of there. So Fort
Oh.
Missoula, yeah, it was the regional headquarters for the CCC. Yeah, so a lot of extra support buildings were constructed for the CCC, which by the time 1941 rolls around, you're left with a pretty empty Fort Missoula with a lot of support structures. It's the perfect place if you want to put people there.
Right.
And that's where the ADC comes in, because first ones are Italians right about this time of year, actually, in 1941. These are all guys taken off of like merchant vessels, some cruise ships, people working in the US. They've all been trapped since 1939, the outbreak of the war, and are effectively stranded. Visas expire, and perfect excuse for INS to pick them up and send them somewhere to be held and detained. And that's where Fort Missoula comes in. We were right on a rail line, easy to get to. We're kind of in the middle of nowhere.
So where did they bring most of them from?
Yeah, so most of these Italians that first came to Fort Missoula, they were, again, off of different ships. Some of them had been seized in, like, New York City. One ship where about half of them came out of was actually out of the Panama Canal, which was U.S.-run at the time. And it was a cruise ship. It was a luxury liner. So you had this staff of about 500 that end up getting detained and sent to Missoula. And everyone from the captain on down to the cabin boys and the band, the chefs, and, you know, everybody that makes a luxury liner work, all of a sudden they find themselves imprisoned in the middle of Montana.
Wow. That's just crazy. Yeah. So do you know who made those determinations? Who were the people that were making that decision?
Yeah, so it's all from the top down. So the Italians came to Fort Missoula because of a stipulation in the Land Lease Act and just immigration technicalities. It's just a case of people in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah,
they're joined after December 7th by Japanese.
Right.
So
there was how many Italians? 1,000?
Roughly about 1,000. At any given time, and about 1,000 to 1,200 or so, we say, that show up in, you know, the months after Pearl Harbor. And in their case, it's a situation of racism and xenophobia, to put it bluntly. I mean, these were guys who were profiled as potentially dangerous enemy aliens simply because they were Japanese. Most of them had been living in the U.S. as legal residents since, you know, decades in some cases. Some guys had come as early as the 1890s. And they're all kind of on the older side. Average age is about 60. But the youngest was, youngest one I could find was 16. The oldest was 84.
Wow.
All because they were born in Japan, and by technicality, by U.S. law, they could not become naturalized citizens.
Right.
Not until 1952 could anybody of Asian origin, you know, naturalize, which is mind-boggling, thinking, like, there's people alive today who were around when that was a thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so a lot of these guys had been put on an FBI watch list because they were opinion leaders. They were cultural leaders, businessmen, guys who had ties to Japanese, you know, cultural organizations or... I'm curious, Russell, what would you think would get you on the FBI's radar and sent to Fort Missoula for being potentially dangerous?
Well, probably anyone who was perceived as even mildly threatening because they have some position of power and influence.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's guys who are, you know, they're a religious leader in town, or they run a Japanese language newspaper. One of my favorite stories to tell is of Gaseki Sakamoto. He went by Robert. Tells you how acculturated he is.
I mean,
he's a guy who was born in Japan. He's 72-ish in 1941. I can't remember. He's over 70, though. And real just little guy, maybe 5'3", 110 pounds, soaking wet. Sounds really dangerous, right?
Yeah.
He was a fruit salesman.
Oh, my gosh.
What got him on his radar was he was an Imperial Japanese Army veteran from the 1890s. He'd been sending money back once a year to a Japanese veterans organization. Yeah, it would be like if we threw a Vietnam vet in prison for donating to the VFW, like to put it in perspective. It boils down to people were panicked. People were freaking out. They saw a face that was not like theirs, and it was easy. Every single one of those Issei men that were there had to go through a loyalty hearing to determine whether or not they were actually a threat. Shockingly, they didn't find anybody guilty of anything. And one of them was, yeah, his kid's school homework was a drawing of the Panama Canal. And, it's just like, yeah, this is definitely proof that you're plotting to do something. It's like, man, it's my kid's geography homework, man.
So when the war ended, were they automatically released, or how did that work?
Yeah, so what happened is it's complicated, and it's why the story hasn't really been told a lot, because there are so many different individual stories in it that are all different. So a lot of these guys, after their loyalty hearings, a good portion of them were paroled, yeah, to go with their families to war relocation authority camps, so like Minidoka, Manzanar, Heart Mountain. Yeah, so there's a million and one different stories. Each internee is remarkably different. Like the Italians, they were either sent back to Italy, or some guys actually managed to stay in the U.S. But that started like with them in September, October 1943. The Italians started getting to go. But Japanese, yeah, it's extremely complicated.
And I would imagine there wasn't any kind of compensation to them after, like, did any of them sue or?
$25 and a bus ticket. That's what you got. Yeah, for 4 years of your life, 5 years of your life in some cases.
That's amazing.
I don't know if anybody ever sued. I don't think they did, but people did get that apology letter and a payment from the Reagan administration back in the 80s.
Oh,
A
really?
lot of people, yeah, so Reagan apologized for what happened to Japanese Americans, and there was a payment. I don't remember off the top of my head how much it was, but they were given a payment as sort of compensation for what had happened to them, a reparation payment. I know a lot of people who have family ties to that talk about, yeah, my grandfather who experienced, like Fort Missoula or Fort Lincoln or any one of the ADC and INS camps, they were gone by the time those came around. And, because most of them were older men. I mean, we unfortunately lost a lot of our living connection to the Japanese internee story really early on. I mean, it's just sad, because part of why we know the Italian story so well is that the average age of those guys was like 25. Way younger, they lived a lot longer. And some of them stayed in Missoula. They lived there because they found a tie to the community, because their experience was a little bit better. Because again, they looked like the people who lived in the town. There was an Italian community in Missoula, and guys married in and were just, like one of the other guys from the old country kind of thing. They didn't have to face what, the Issei did. Like in Missoula, up until about 10 years ago, we had living internees in our community.
So when did the fort close?
Great question. This is where it gets kind of interesting. So the Alien Detention Center officially closed in 1944, but the Army continued to use Fort Missoula like it had before the war, up until about 1947, 1948. But elements in the Army Reserve did not officially get themselves out of Fort Missoula until 2001. So, in some way, shape, or form, Fort Missoula was still an active military post in a way up until 2001.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
So
and
what were these people doing that were stationed there?
I have no idea. That's a part of the sports history.
Probably just
I
need sweeping the floors and stuff.
Pretty much. But ironically, they were using old buildings from the internment camp. I mean, even today, like the Forest Service regional headquarters is based out of those same buildings.
Oh.
It's a living place. Like, that's the thing that's really cool about Fort Missoula, is where all of its contemporaries, a lot of them are gone. Fort Missoula is still finding ways to be relevant in the community. And I find it really interesting that nowadays it's a lot more positive than what the fort's past history has been. Something that is good to see. I mean, we've gone from being a place that started out killing and deporting and removing natives from their ancestral homelands to a place that, you know, used African Americans to do that, to a place that was, I'll admit, the CCC is probably our most objectively positive.
Yeah.
You can't really find something wrong with the CCC from that to the ADC and just all these layers of history. The fact that it's still relevant today as a place and is becoming a more positive community space, I think that's really cool. And just shows you how history can kind of turn and flip as the years go by.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. One thing I was curious about is, so now that with this funding shift, have they dictated to you what you're allowed to talk about, or can you still give programs on this history?
Thankfully, no. That's the beauty of the county government.
Okay, good.
Step below, so we have a lot of freedom and leeway. For now, we've got a level of cushion for us that is kind of nice. It doesn't stop the work and the mission of making sure that people remember this place and what happened here.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't think a lot of Montanans know what happened there. I mean, I've always been surprised how often I bring up that particular place and people don't know anything about the history of it. So it's, I appreciate you taking the time to fill us in.
It's painfully relevant today.
Yes, totally. That's exactly why I wanted to talk to you about it. It's one of those, thank God that cannot happen now kind of things.
Yeah, there's a line in the last chunk of our little documentary on the Kaylee Detention Center where Carol, who wrote the book on the place, but she just simply asks, you know, didn't we learn anything from this? I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
It's that I'm not really sure that makes it important to remember that place.
Exactly, yes. Nasty old click of them heels, wind up spinning the wheel. Thank you for joining me for this episode of 56 Counties. I'm Russell Rowland, and I've been talking with Austin Haney, the education assistant at Fort Missoula. You can listen to this episode in full or any past episodes at ypradio.org. I'd also like to thank my son Fletcher for providing the musical interludes and Aaron Parrott for the theme song. Join me again on the first Monday of each month for 56 Counties.